Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face. So my interview today is my first interview that I've done. Now, this may not be the first interview that I actually publish, but for TIFF 2018, the Toronto International Film Festival, I was on the line direct to Mumbai. How fun is that, with Nandita Das to talk about her new film, Manto. This is a beautiful gift, I think, for all of us. This is a film that you're going to need to see, and frankly, it's another one of those interviews I think you're going to need to hear. You're going to find out why Nandita is such a open book, and probably find out a little bit why this film received a 4-minute standing ovation at Cannes. I mean, how amazing is that? This is a movie about hypocrisy. This is a movie about freedom. This is a movie about censorship. It's about being rooted locally, as Nandita says, and to our own reality and truth. It's about context and about inequality and gender disparity. We talk about Oscar Wilde. We talk about deep conviction and how that leads to courage. Courage follows from deep conviction. We talk about the film as well, and about the comedic edge, and about this man who stood up to the status quo, who stood up to the communities that he moved and lived within, and said there has to be a better way. And we talk about does art actually lead to activism, and we raise a lot of questions, and we have a lot of fun doing it. So please stay tuned and listen in. And don't forget, davidpecklive.com for more information about my writing and speaking, and facetofacelive.ca for more info too about my podcasting. You'll find I'm going to be doing a lot of interviews at the Toronto International Film Festival this year. And don't forget, if you want to support the work I'm doing here at Face to Face, you can do that through Patreon. .com. And please share this interview with as many people as you can. They call it a global community for a reason. Coming right up, Nandita Das, and talking about her new film, Manto.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by a very special guest here today with us, all the way from Mumbai, actually, calling in. And Nandita Das is here to speak about her new film, Manto, which is going to be a special presentation at the Toronto International Film Festival. Nandita, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you. No, I'm sure we're going to have a fun conversation.
I'm so coming fresh off seeing the film. I just can't wait to dive in. You are an eclectic person. I'd love to hear a little bit more about your history and your CV and your resume. You've been acting for years. You're a director. You're a writer. I saw a TEDx talk recently with you. I'm just fascinated by your history and I love the film, by the way. And congratulations on Manto. Thank you so much for that.
Well, that means a lot to me, because that's the state of mind I am in. And we've only shown Manto where we did our world premiere in Cannes, which was a great start.
Yeah, no kidding.
And then we were at Sydney, then we were at Sydney for the Australian premiere. And so I haven't shown it to a lot of people. So I'm still very curious as to how people receive it. You know, when you make a film, you're telling your story in your own way with your perspective. And it's so subjective. So you're always curious to know how is an audience kind of reacting to it. So I'm glad you liked it. Thank you.
And can you tell us a little bit about the reaction in Cannes? How, or do you want to sort of...
So we had a world premiere in this beautiful theater. It was packed. I was, of course, nervous. We had to present it, and there were 24 of us. And usually they only get the main cast and the director. So there are two or three people on stage. And I told them I'd like to get all the 24 of them. So first they almost sort of fell off their chair, and he said, "Are you serious?"
So 24 people from the film.
From the film. That's, lots of them had made the effort to fly all the way.
That's
and the
fantastic.
And the crew at their own cost. So having been on the jury in Cannes twice, I knew the head of Cannes very well. So I told Thierry Frémaux, I said, "You know, I know you've traveled the world. I'm sure you can do this and just pronounce all those difficult Indian names. But these people have come from all over India and, you know, such a long journey. So can I just please get them all?" So I saw him rattling away these 24 names, and he was like, phew, at the end of it, he was kind of exhausted. And then I looked at him and I said, "Thierry, I'm really sorry." And he said, "It's okay, that's India." And, you know, that kind of got some laughs. But when the film finished, it was quite overwhelming because we got a 4-minute standing ovation.
Wow.
And, you know, and I have been to Cannes, and they're not always very kind.
Right,
they walk out in the middle. And it's probably the only festival that's of professionals from the film industry. It's not a ticketed, you know, for a regular audience festival.
Right. Very different than the Toronto Film Festival.
Exactly. Or like many other. I mean, I don't know if there's any festival that I know of which is completely for film professionals and, you know, those who have been accredited. So it is a unique festival, and they are all very discerning, and they've watched a variety of films. And it's not some cutting edge film. I mean, it's not sort of playing with form in a, you know, very big way. It's in that sense, it's fairly classic. It's simple. Mm. It's linear. And also the context, I wasn't sure whether the French and the others would understand because it's a bit different. And I haven't really kept in mind trying to sort of appease the whole world because you can't. You have to be local and rooted to your reality and truth. So I was kind of nervous and wondering how it's going to be. But there was a 65-year-old French woman behind me, and she was crying away. And there were a lot of people who were just walking out quietly, who didn't want to engage at all. But you could see they were kind of tense and just wanted to be with it. But, you know, it was kind of varied reaction because all of us process emotions differently. But all in all, it just seemed like somewhere it had touched people. Not in a sentimental sort of way, because that wasn't the intention. But just in some way, I think they related to it, I guess. And I was happy about that.
A 4-minute standing ovation is amazing. So congratulations on that. Hopefully we can at least equal that here in Toronto. I'll get the word on this. I'll get the word on the street for you. So you just mentioned context. You know, it's about it's about context being rooted locally to one's reality and truth. What a beautiful phrase. He when he's on trial right near the end of the film, he talks about, you know, if you want to critique my work, basically, is the line to some degree, then you need to do it in context. Isn't it kind of all about context, all of what we're talking about here?
Absolutely. And he says if you want to judge a writer, you've got to see his or her entire work, body of work, and you've got to see the context in which he or she has written. So you can't just take one word or one line and call it obscene, because he was tried for obscenity 6 times.
Wow, yeah.
And he talks about what is really literature, and he says with changing times, literature must also evolve. So the things he says are so, they're so modern. I mean, this was 70 years ago, and yet it holds true. You know, these are the battles we as artists and writers are still fighting. So it's not unusual for us to be, you know, sort of saying that, yes, it is very relevant.
Do you think his, you know what, maybe you should provide, if you can, without, you know, too many, you know, spoilers to the film, can you provide a little context for the listener? I'm going to assume a lot of people who are listening, it's even going to be post-TIFF, and they may not have seen the film, and can you give us a little bit about this man and his life and what he was all about? I love the fact that he was compared. I'm a huge fan of Oscar Wilde, by the way, and when I started to do a bit of research, I noticed that definitely a few comparisons, you know, the pushback, mm-hmm. the obscenity,
absolutely.
You know, and so on. But yeah, so could you root but us a little bit in the story?
Yeah, I mean, there were many, I call them Manto-esque people almost, you know. I mean, Oscar Wilde also said, be yourself because every other person is taken or you know, everyone else has been taken.
That's
so Manto
right.
was really himself.
That's right,
you know,
yeah.
He was a contrarian. Like Oscar Wilde again said that I can resist any temptation. What? I can resist anything but temptation.
But temptation, yes, it's
but
so
temptation.
Great, yeah.
So, you know, so he was, and so was Manto. He was a progressive writer of the 40s, and that was a time there were many other progressive writers as well who were resisting orthodoxy, who was, you know, challenging it. The difference was, one, he didn't want to be part of any association, like any progressive, there was a big progressive writers association. He felt he didn't want to be part of any kind of group. You know, he was so on his own, like in the sense, there was a bit of arrogance as well.
Sure,
but
yeah.
an arrogance not in the way we understand, but in a way that, you know, when you're just self-assured, when you're just comfortable in your skin, when you kind of just know that what you're saying is coming from a very deep sense of truth. So that was Manto. He died at a very young age. Mm. He died at 42. And he left 300 short stories behind him. He had hundreds of radio plays. He also did scripts for films. You know, he did sketches, as in literary sketches on famous people of the time. So he was very, very prolific. And even till the very end, even though he was tried 6 times for obscenity, and he had to, for reasons that will be evident in the film, that despite his love for Bombay, he had to move to Lahore because there was sectarian violence during the partition of India, which gave birth to Pakistan as a new country. So the day we were independent from the British rule, which was for about 200 years, simultaneously there was also partition, and there was the largest mass migration in the world till date, which a lot of the Westerners don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really was a very trying and difficult time, and Manto took it all very personally. For him, it wasn't about the numbers and the statistics. All his stories are very intimate. It's really about how people respond to violence, how people respond to prejudice, to, you know, identity politics. He really invoked an identity which was beyond national and religious identity. I know I've kind of taken off on Manto, but it comes from that place of having genuine admiration for a person who stuck his neck out and given a chance, he would do it 10 times over despite all the challenges.
What's so beautiful. I mean, I didn't know the story. I didn't know the writer. So, you know, just,
most
I mean,
people
it's,
won't.
Yeah,
most people
which is,
won't, and
which,
that's the idea.
Isn't that the idea? And isn't it wonderful? And I think I heard an interview where you said, you know, it was so challenging to raise funds just, you know, around this film and how difficult it was, you know, for such a relevant, meaningful story to get those people who might be interested to actually write the checks. And you just kind of wonder, you know, the amount of commitment and passion that you would need in order to see a story like this through, to me is remarkable. So he says at one point, you know, just to sort of take off on your comment about the numbers. You just mentioned about the numbers weren't that important to him. I wonder, did I hear a little bit of, I think the quote from the film was, you know, he says something to the effect of either everyone's life matters or no one's does. And he was, I mean, he really was about the individual, right? He really was about the importance of focusing on the one and then the many. Does that make sense?
Yes, absolutely. For him, each life matters. But like I said, not based on the religion or the nationality,
right.
narrow sense of identity. So he meant, like, you know, if you care for one, you've got to care for everybody. It's not that this particular person's life is more important, whether it's dependent on class or gender or religion or all these things. We do live in a very unequal society, mm-hmm. and we have kind of normalized that inequality.
Right.
We've all kind of just taken it as a given. And he challenged that, and through his writing, and he used to bring out the worst. He used to say that, you can bring out the worst in the best of people, and vice versa. That, the worst of people are redeemable. So his stories, well, that's why complex and yet simple, in the sense that this, once you understand this idea, it's not so difficult. But in a world where we are always looking at binary things and looking at, are you for or against, do you like this or that?
Right.
In that kind of a system, you also realize that embracing that ambiguity, that complexity is also important.
Why, as you, writer and director of the film, you've clearly carried this story around with you for a long time. What do you think, okay. What do you think it is that drives somebody like that? The writers, the artists of the world. I mean, you obviously tap into mm-hmm. your own experience as well, but, here's a guy 70 years ago who clearly rolled his sleeves up in every possible way, metaphorically and literally, and said, I'm not going to put up with the status quo. I know that we can do better than this. What is it that, lit the fire in his soul, if that makes any sense?
I think the commonality that I find, whether it's in Manto and many other people who have just, whether they're artists or writers or activists, is actually conviction.
Mm.
When you have a deep conviction about something, you don't need to seek courage. Like, a lot of people ask me, how come you did Fire as your first film? In fact, that's by a Canadian Indian mm-hmm. director, Deepa Mehta, who did a film about a relationship between two women. Of course, at that time, I didn't know there was going to be even a second film, because
right.
I just did it for the experience of it, and I thought it was a powerful story. Or when I did my first film, which was Firaq, which was, again, deals with human relationships on a post-violence scenario and how people respond to violence when the obvious violence gets over. Or Manto, which is a period film and much larger in canvas than the budget and the time I had. So I think, at least in my life, and I'm imagining that's what drives people, is just conviction. Because if you have those convictions, then courage will follow. You don't have to seek courage. You don't have to say, there's no battle within.
Right.
How do I do this? Where do I tap into that courage? The conviction takes you through it, because you're so deeply wanting to sort of tell that story or do that work, or, you deeply care about something. You think of it as your own. When the political and the personal become one, you don't need to worry about the rest. Everything else just follows, and, you just find it. Like a journalist asked me 2 days ago, said, has the interest in Manto waned, considering you've been at it for 6 years? And I thought, I never even thought about it, And because in those six years, first of all, there were different phases.
Right.
First, you're writing it and you're realizing, my God, this short life, but there was so much that happened. I started with a 10-year story, which kept getting shorter and shorter and ended up being a 4-year story from 46 to 52. So it's not a cradle-to-grave story anyways. And I just lost the train of thought.
Oh, no, that's okay. You were talking about the longevity of the story and how you went to,
I just come back to it. So basically, whether the writing phase was about what to keep and what to throw,
right.
then to raise money, then whom are you telling this story to? There are some great, amazing Manto experts, very few, but they know everything, and you want to leave a nugget for them and for those in the middle, and a large number of people who know nothing about Manto. And yet, this is not a Wikipedia page where I'm going to tell them who Manto was. And, so that had its own challenges. Then collecting cast and crew, raising funds, mm-hmm. finding locations in cities that are so cluttered with modern-day air conditions, hoarding, satellite.
Right.
So it's just every phase has had its excitement and challenges. And And you're also, it's for me, films has always been a means to an end. So it has never been pure art. And there is enough logic for those who say, why can't art be for art's sake? And sure, it can be. But for me, somehow, it doesn't work. And I'm a daughter of a painter who I've grown up, you know, seeing my father paint and meet all his friends who are artists, writers, architects, you know, musicians. So a lot of them were just great artists, and they don't have to be activists. So it's not that you have to have a social conscience about everything. You can create beautiful art, and although beautiful art has its own, you know, sort of it revolutionizes things in its own way.
Sure, yep.
Because it kind of touches you and
hopefully changes the way you see to some degree.
Absolutely. I mean, can you imagine a world without art? It's almost unthinkable.
Do you think
it's not an
Nandita, do you think good art leads to activism?
I think activism is the other extreme, and not all of us need to be or can be or are activists. But I think social conscience is something that we can all carry, and not in a sort of magnanimous way of, oh, I'm doing this for the world because the world has given me so much, my payback time or nothing. I mean, I just look at it as just makes my life more meaningful. I'm here for a short while. I'm a, you know, speck of dust in this big, huge universe, or a drop of ocean, a drop in the ocean. But I've got to make my life interesting and meaningful so that I can be a full drop. And, you know, so it's a fine line. And that's all. I mean, that's my reason. It makes me feel more engaged. I feel, and Gandhi, I mean, that's my mantra. Gandhi said, if you want to see the change, you know, be part of that.
Be
change.
Part of it.
Be the change you want to see in the world.
Well, now you're talking it seems to me, about that conviction that leads to the courage.
Absolutely. And we all want to see a better world. I don't think there's anyone who's going to say, no, I don't want a greener world. I don't want a more peaceful world. I don't want a happier world. But it's not going to happen on its own if you're not going to be part of that. I think so one doesn't have to be activists. Just if we all do our respective work, whatever that may be, we all have an area of influence. So if we can just do it with a little bit of social conscience and a little bit of care and passion, I think we're fine. And film does require so much money, so many people, so much goes into it. Why would you waste that opportunity to not tell something that you care about?
Yeah, no, it's lovely. Well, listen, I, for what it's worth, I mean, I'm no film critic, but I thought you captured the time so well, and right from the get go, I was engaged. I was in. I mean, everyone, the cast.
Did the context, did it confuse you at any point?
Well, no, but it was a real, you know, the way you weave the storytelling in within the storytelling, which is so beautiful to me. It kind of shocked me out of my complacency, if that makes any sense, as I was watching the film.
Because it suddenly throws you off.
Sometimes
you don't know whether you've entered a story or not. But I wanted to also do that because even in Manto's stories, the line between fact and fiction are so blurred.
It's so great that you bring that up. That's a question I wanted to ask you, you know, as a storyteller, as an actor, as a director, how important is that to you? So many questions around that. What's truth and what is an actually, is it important to get the facts right? Or is it more about the intention of the story and what it actually sort of points to, right? The truth that it points to.
Right. I think there's no clear answer to that though, because I wanted to get the facts right, for instance. You know, because I'm also not a professional filmmaker. I've never gone to a film school.
Could have fooled me, Nandina.
Sorry?
You could have fooled me. You're not a professional filmmaker.
Thank you. No, but sometimes it frees you up, you
sure.
know, when you don't know the grammar of something too well.
So great,
you're not
yeah.
sort of taught by, like, how it should be done. You just go more by instinct. And, of course, instinct also is something that you have that is groomed and nurtured over the years. Everything, every experience that you have kind of nurtures your instinct as well. Mm-hmm. It's not just sitting in the gut. So I guess life experiences teach you things, and, you know, growing up with an artist, so it gives you a certain visual sense, Loving music gives you a sense of sound. Being an actor helps you communicate with actors. So, and, you know, having written the script, I was so close to the material, I almost knew what I wanted. And having said that, it's still 60% of what you want, because there are 100 other factors that play on you and the whole process. Everything is not in your control, but you still try and do the best you can and bring out the vision that you have and communicate that to your cast and crew. But I did, right from the beginning, I was clear that I wanted to weave in the stories. And I felt like I needed to give everyone a glimpse of those stories, because why should you believe that Manto was sensitive, that he had a
right.
special empathy for women, or that he was a great writer and all of that? And I think it's like if you're going to do a film on Mozart or Van Gogh and not see their work, that would be strange. So,
well, I think for me, that my experience was that it actually heightened not only the tension but also the horror of the implications of some of the stories that he chose to tell, which then has implications on how you see what's truly obscene here. What's truly mm-hmm. obscene is what's actually going on, and right?
Exactly.
And that's where you start to go, okay, is this really happening, what I'm watching right now, or is yeah. that one of the stories that he was telling? So I think it really amplified the impact for me, and it definitely is a film for me that requires more than one viewing, that's for sure.
Yeah, I think so also, because it is layered, and that was the idea, because, you know, anybody's life, it's complex.
Mm-hmm.
And when I watch a Spanish film, like if I watch an Almodovar film, or I watch a Kurosawa film, or, you know, any other context, like a Wong Kar-wai film, I don't understand every word of it.
That's right.
Of course, yep. They mention different things that are new to me, but I, if it's a good film, I connect with it. It stirs something in my mind and heart. And I let go of those nitty-gritties. But those nitty-gritties also make it authentic. I mean, even a regular Hollywood film like Sully, you know, if you've seen that, mm-hmm. with, about this pilot, right?
Yes.
Tom Hanks plays that role. And there is so much of the airline jargon, like, you know, whatever goes into the vocabulary that pilots would speak with the ground staff and all of that. And we don't understand that. But when they do it authentically, transports you into that context, which is important. And once you believe, once you buy into that context, then you sort of latch on to the universal emotions that in any case you relate to. So I don't think there are portions that you may not understand as well as maybe somebody who understands in India, or somebody in Bombay who's lived through this city may get something that somebody in Chennai or Delhi
right,
may not understand.
Right.
So you know how far are you going to spoon feed people?
I think too, on some level, I think you've already alluded to it, but I think great art or great storytelling, Richard Wagamese is a formerly a Canadian First Nations mm. author, Indigenous author, and he said that stories are meant to heal. And I've always loved that phrase, and I'm mm. starting to really reflect more and more on that. I think the act of, you know, isn't it a beautiful line? The act of telling
What's
the story.
Name you said?
His name is, yeah, first name is Richard, and his yeah, last name is Wagamese. I can send it along to you, but it's Wagamese. Yeah, Wagamese. And
M-E-S-E,
yes, yeah, yeah, and beautiful storyteller, okay. and the idea that, you know, the telling of the story, the receiving of it, the conversation mm-hmm. that exists around it, and the fact that it sits,
mm-hmm.
it sits with the person, it sits with the community, it sits with the storyteller. I love at the beginning of the film, wasn't it his wife who asks his wife something about, don't you fear father's eyes? And she says something
exactly.
like, not as much as your stories.
Not as much, you know, yeah. When my father's eyes scare you, he's like, not as much as your stories.
That's right.
The story kind of begins almost in a happy way, and suddenly it becomes sinister, and you almost think, oh my God, what's going to happen?
Mm.
And it not only the punch is no, whatever, the end is not about the fact that it happens or not, but that everyone has their own dignity, and that,
mm.
I mean, I don't want to give away, that's why I'm hesitating to say, but, you know, he gives so much integrity and dignity to women, and especially sex workers, that nobody was writing about at that time, or even now, and treating people as marginalized as they may be, but as human beings, as people. And I think that's pretty unique.
I think it's amazing. There's also right near the beginning of the film, and I think it's right around that in that same scene, and I can't remember who said it, but she's not a girl, she's a firecracker.
Yeah.
And I wondered to what degree is that kind of representative of one of the themes that you had in the film, you know, this firecracker, there's a whole lot of potential there. There's this explosive edge, you know, you could go cliche, but I think there's more going on there than meets the eye for sure.
Yeah, no, that's true. And everyone's going to find their own meanings as well. Like, to be honest, I never thought of firecracker. I didn't really connect to fire. But I'm happy you did.
Yeah, well, I don't know. You know, maybe it's a bit of a stretch, but I do love those kinds of threads, those thematic threads that sometimes it seems to me are revealed on a second and third viewing. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why you go back to
Absolutely.
A great film. It's why you read a poem a second and third and fourth time.
Yeah.
You know, it's been my experience anyway.
No, and that's why you want to make sure that film like this doesn't just end up with festivals, which is a great platform, but actually gets distributed.
Sure.
Otherwise, films like these get a label that, oh, they're just festival films. But there's no level playing field because everywhere the mainstream cinema is what gets the most amount of traction because just that there are more takers, more distributors and exhibitors and producers bet their money on. And I wish films like these, which you can't really box, it's not like a completely indie film. It's neither like a Bollywood mainstream cinema. It's just a film that hopefully people across board would be able to relate and take something from it, if not everything.
Do you think, like Manto, that we still live in unbearable times? I wonder to what degree his work would his work have been published today? I think, you know, would he have created as much of a stir today? Would he have been in jail by now? You know, I mean, I think these are some pretty interesting questions, not only about censorship, but about a whole lot
what
of things.
What people are writing and it's self-censorship, right? I mean, a lot of people, especially where there is sort of more institutional censorship, people are kind of bowing down before they are being asked to. So it's also that, you know, society can't grow if our artists and writers are not going to have the space was free speech and, you know, freedom of expression. And that's not really an India problem. I mean, there are books that have been banned in America. There are films in Cannes this year. There were two films that were banned in their respective countries, an Iranian and a Kenyan film, and they were being showcased in Cannes. So it is happening in different degrees. Sometimes there are big corporations who buy out media houses. I mean, all of these are sort of unsaid forms of censorship. You know, there are lobbies that don't allow a certain thing to come out, a certain fact to come out. So we do live in sort of unbearable times in many different ways. And while Manto was censored then and is celebrated now, but there are Manto-esque people living now and who are struggling for that space. And, you know, there's a fair amount of stifling happening to their freedom. I mean, there was a journalist in India who was actually shot dead was speaking up her mind. I knew her well, actually. She was in Bangalore called Gauri Lankesh. There have been other rationalists and, you know, sort of just liberals who have been attacked and shot dead. Mm. So, you know, so these are times where we need to reflect more definitely and therefore also celebrate those who have shown us the path, who have sort of put their neck on the line because that's kind of inspirational.
Do you think to some degree that we're all storytellers? I mean, maybe we don't. I love your phrase, Manto-esque, by the way. I just love that. So, and I will be using that in the future, just so you know. But do you think we? Yeah. And is it about just kind of practicing the craft or the art of storytelling around the dinner table, over a coffee, over a drink, a glass of wine, etc.? I mean, is that?
Yeah. I mean, that's why films will never be obsolete. I think or story writing.
Oh, that's so good. Yeah.
You know, in literature, because there may be less people, the form might change, but we will always tell stories because we love stories. We are voyeurs as well. If somebody is telling you a story, you're like, oh, really? Did that happen to her? Did he do that? I mean, you know, we enjoy spinning stories, and all of us do. And there are people who hear us. Some may have 10 people, some may have 10,000 or 10 million. But the thing is, we all have listeners as well to those stories. So some are better storytellers than others, but I think stories are very powerful. And yes, they can heal. Although art has also been misused. Art
right.
has also been
sure.
propaganda to spread lies. So, you know, as idealists, I would have never said that. But the realist in me says, well, we'll have to differentiate good art and art that is misused. And then that brings us to the question, what is good art? Because that's subjective. You know, what's good for you may not be for me. But then I guess time is the only judge. You know,
right.
I mean, when writers or a piece of work of literature or art that has really stood the test of time, that's what we can look back and say, Michelangelo was great, or Van Gogh was great, or Matisse, or whatever, you know, Bach or Beethoven and all of that, because they are just timeless and spaceless. So I think that's the only way we can. That's why we need to just have really honest intent and conviction in what we do.
So good.
We don't know how people are going to really process it and like it or not.
And sadly, we're going to have to wrap up our conversation here in a couple of minutes. It's heartbreaking to me. I could keep going all night.
I'm enjoying it too.
Oh, good. Good. So glad. I was going to say there's a comedic edge to the film. I don't know if I'd go there. There's definitely wonderful moments.
He's a writer after all, and, you know, he's got his tongue in cheek.
Yeah, yeah.
Like in the courtroom, he suddenly sort of branches out and recites a kind of almost like an obscene poetry to a priest. And he's like, what the hell are you even talking about? You know, and that kind of leads him to saying that you cannot just pick a word or a sentence, what we were talking earlier.
Yes.
You've got to see the context, and you've got to see this poet's entire work and understand where he's coming from.
There's a great moment, a kind of a laugh out moment for me, and you can help me with the actual phrasing, but I think they're drinking and they talk about, you know, or I think he says something to his friend about it's people drink to endure pain or to relieve their conscience or something like that. And his friend says, yes, that's not working out too well for you, you know?
Yes. It's neither numbing his conscience or silencing it. And then somebody, you know, actually it was a great director called K. Asif, who made one of those biggest iconic classic films. And he comes to him with another script and he said, did you like it? And he says, no, it was terrible.
That's right. Utter rubbish or something.
What? He said, I actually take a fees for my opinion.
That's right.
My wife said, are you kidding me? Like, what are you doing? He's like, I was joking, but, you know, if he wants to give it, I'll take it. So, yeah, he had sort of a humor too in the way that he sort of lived his life and what he said.
Well, he clearly wanted to disrupt people, but it wasn't pointless. Like, he wasn't doing it like lifestyle advertising. He wasn't doing it just to disrupt.
It was provocative
with a purpose, almost. You know, with intention.
In fact, he says, I don't know if I still left it in the film, in one of my drafts, it was there that someone says, "Why are you so provocative?" And he says, "Anything worth writing is going to be provocative in these times."
Yes.
And it's so true. Even today, I would say that, you know, anything worth writing or reading or seeing that really touches you is going to be provocative. So, yeah.
Well, I think it's a beautiful sort of way we can end on a provocative note. I think that's not such a bad place to end. I can't tell you how thrilled I am to have been able to get you on the phone. And thank you so much for this conversation.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it. And please spread the word. I'm coming to Toronto in September, and I've been coming to Toronto for many years, films as an actress. And Firaq, my first film, had its world premiere there. But this time I'm coming after 10 years, and I'm sure the city has grown and changed, and so has the festival. But it's a festival I really like, so I'm looking forward to it.
Well, I hope you do have a wonderful time, and I do hope we actually get to meet each other face-to-face and shake hands and say hello.
Yes, why don't you come for one of the screenings?
I hope I can do that.
Publicly, that you it needs a second view.
That's right. I'm now on record.
Grab a coffee and you can tell me whether it still holds as much attention.
Oh, that's wonderful. We've been talking to Nandita Das today about her new film, Manto, premiering at the Toronto International Film Festival. Thanks so much for your time today, Nandita.
Thank you, David.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.